WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with George Tenet. The former director of Central Intelligence is on a book tour promoting his memoir, At the Center of the Storm. He writes that WMD was the reason given to the public for invading Iraq. The real reason was core beliefs, larger geostrategic calculations, ideology, and the view that the democratic transformation of the Middle East through regime change in Iraq would be worth the price. In the comic book series The American Way, a group of superheroes defends America from communist supervillains. But the heroes and villains are created by the government, and the battles are staged just to make Americans feel good about the government's ability to protect them. We'll talk with John Ridley about writing The American Way. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's part of the CIA's job to keep secrets, but this week, its former head is being called on to answer a lot of questions. George Tenet is on his book tour, promoting his memoir, At the Center of the Storm, My Years at the CIA. Among the issues the book addresses are the controversies surrounding Tenet's leadership of the agency in the lead-up to the September 11th attacks and the invasion of Iraq. Tenet was appointed by President Clinton to serve as Director of Central Intelligence in 1997. President George W. Bush kept him in that position. Tenet resigned in 2004 in the wake of criticisms over intelligence that was used as part of the justification for invading Iraq. George Tenet, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you write in your book that the weapons of mass destruction was the public face that was put on the war in Iraq. The real reason was, quote, core beliefs, larger geostrategic calculations, ideology, and the view that the democratic transformation of the Middle East through regime change in Iraq would be worth the price. So one of the real reasons for the war in Iraq, you're saying, was ideology. Did you think you were being asked to find intelligence that would support the ideology?
No, I didn't. And we have to look at this very, very carefully. I mean, let's look at the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction and what intelligence has said about that. We've been writing about this. I've been involved in thinking and writing about this going back to the Clinton administration. This is a story that we thought we understood. We followed Saddam in the 90s when we have UN inspectors, when we lost UN inspectors. We followed a regime that deceived and denied a very difficult intelligence target. The truth was, it turns out, when you do an evaluation and you step back and say, well, you were wrong. Why did you get it wrong? There were professional reasons. There were reasons that dealt with how we thought about history. We thought the biological weapons file was closed and he reopened it. How did you think about the first Gulf War when you got on the ground in Iraq and his nuclear weapons program was much further along than you predicted? So there was history. There was deception. There was denial. There was, from 98 forward, when the inspectors left, lots of technical data that caused us a great deal of concern, particularly with regard to his procurement mechanism. And interestingly, Terry, even after the estimate was printed, there was some insightful, very valuable human reporting that told us chemical and biological production continued, that told us he understood how to deceive inspectors and was going to implement a program to do so. So we came to these conclusions on our own. I've said publicly in a number of places, no one told us what to say or how to say it. And when we step back, we understand that there were great shortcomings in what we wrote and how we wrote it. And that's pretty much how the WMD story transpired. Now, there's a lot, Silberman, Rob, the Congress, lots of people have gotten underneath lots of those issues. I think at root, Saddam said something to his FBI debriefer that's really interesting in the context of deception, and he said, you cannot expect Iraq to give up a rifle and live only with a sword. And what he was saying in that time period, the interpretation is, I can never let the Iranians believe that we don't have this capability. Well, in any event, but the fear in this society and how pervasive it was, we were wrong.
But you were saying that the real reason why we invaded Iraq had to do with core beliefs within the Bush administration and ideology.
Well,
at what point did you start to think, well, that's the reason why they're going to war? It's not even about the intelligence. It's about core beliefs and ideology.
Well, Terry, I went back and reflected on all this. I mean, we went back and I looked at documents and I talked to people. And, there was a predisposition on the part of many at the beginning of the administration to think about Iraq and think about the necessity to deal with Iraq in the context of regime change. All I'm saying is this. Countries go to war for lots of reasons, and policymakers, intelligence is one input, somebody's worldview is another input. In this case, the unarticulated view that democratic transformation in the Middle East should begin with Iraq is another input. While the public case was made on the basis of WMD, there were many more factors that went into it. And how you weigh them and what percentage is accorded to each, difficult for me to say, but when you stand up and make policy decisions, it's often much more than just about intelligence.
You write, should we go to war had already been decided in meetings at which we were not present. We were just called in to discuss the how and occasionally how we will explain it to the public. So you're saying that going to war was decided before you had even given a lot of intelligence about whether
I'm saying, Terry, that when I talked to people who went to meetings, when I did the research for the book, the discussions that were occurring at mid-levels and even levels below me seemed to create the impression in the people going to meetings that we were having tactical discussions. We were talking about issues and problems that might emerge in war fighting. We're talking about things that we would have to do to anticipate war. All I'm saying is, and I say something, I think in reflecting on it, I say, I don't recall, and maybe they had these meetings. Maybe there was a discussion. I never recalled a session where everybody is. Remember, the time period is I'm focused on Al-Qaeda and what's happening on the terrorism front 18 hours a day. And in reflecting on this, I wonder whether we would have all been better served if we sat down one day and said, okay, we understand that policymakers don't like Saddam Hussein, and we understand you have a policy interest, and I understand your reasoning. Maybe we'd have all done better if someone had said, let's sit down and rack and stack this and say, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right time to do it? I think if we go back to the summer of 2003, if we looked at what our senior officers were saying on the ground and identifying the insurgency and identifying the problems with debathification, in identifying the problems with disbanding the army, in identifying the problems with taking the Sunni population and essentially pushing it off to the side, I think if you go back and look at all of that quite systematically, intelligence was spot on. We told the story. We performed our jobs. And I guess at the end of the day, that record, I think, is clear and very good. And that's an important piece of the puzzle for people to understand. There's just one final point.
Yeah.
I know you have a lot of questions. I've heard people say in reaction to the book, people have said, well, you knew all of these things before they happened. And if you knew all these things before they happened, why didn't you speak up to stop it? Well, I wish I had that kind of wisdom. I didn't. We didn't. In part, we didn't fully understand at the front end what the back end was going to look like. We really didn't understand what the policy would be on the ground in terms of the post-war reconstruction. And all I can say is what we saw and what we reported was very direct and very honest.
Should we have invaded Iraq as part of the war on terror?
Well, Terry, I don't, obviously, policymakers, I, in this time period.
Did the intelligence tell you that that was a sensible thing to do?
Well, the policy, Terry, here's the distinction again. I don't make the policy. I don't cross that line. I give you a sense of what these concerns may be. I tell you what we know. You factor all that in and make a policy decision. If people believe there was a command relationship, certainly not. There was no command relationship. We never thought so. But there were issues of concern. But again, I would say to you that the decision here, all of the things I previously talked about were probably factored in, and how decisive any of these were, I'd have to ultimately, policymakers will have to speak to that.
You know, there's the famous 16 words that President Bush used in his 2003 State of the Union address, saying that Saddam Hussein had tried to get yellowcake uranium from the African country of Niger that could be used for nuclear weapons. And this was really used to help make the case that we had to, invade Iraq and do regime change there. Now, you had already taken out that information from a speech that Vice President Cheney was going to give. And you said
We took it out of the Cincinnati speech.
Yeah, and you said it wasn't credible that the president was going to make. Excuse me.
Right.
How did it get into a speech the second time around? I know you say you weren't there vetting it, but didn't like the president and his aides already know that the CIA had said, this is incredible, don't use it?
Terry, I can only tell you what our side of the interaction was. I can't speak to the other side of the interaction. I know that when the Cincinnati speech was written, I made a phone call. I said, this has to come out. We followed up with two memos. We sent them downtown, explained why. We go through that. You know, the other issue is that Iraq already had 550 metric tons of yellow cake under seal. So if they wanted to get yellow cake, they could have had it readily available. But our view was, this is not something that we believe is credible. Don't put it in the speech. I thought we were very, very direct about it. I thought we put documents down to make sure that it's not used again. We had to take our share of the responsibility for that because it came back to us, and we didn't object again, and we had a responsibility to do that. But my view was is that responsibility should have been shared immediately. How it got in, why it got in. Look, it's very, very difficult to know the reasons. I can't speculate other than tell you what the record is.
You know, apparently the forged documents that statement was based on were so amateurishly done that an Italian journalist was able to figure out that they were forgeries. So I wonder how they ever got any credibility within the Bush administration.
Well Terry, I have to tell you, the interesting thing is I know the story of the forged documents, but they really don't come into my play in terms of making a determination that we shouldn't use this. I mean, you know, when back in October when we were testifying on the National Intelligence Estimate, people in testimony in Congress asked us, where do you differ with the British white paper? And back in October, we were very explicit about the fact that we didn't buy this Niger story. So documents or no documents, the record of what we said is fairly clear months in advance.
Valerie Plame was outed as part of this story because her husband, the Ambassador Joe Wilson, had gone to Niger to investigate these claims and found that there was no validity to them. So do you walk away from the story thinking that she was intentionally outed to get even at him?
Well, Valerie, again, Valerie was one of our officers, and I reacted. I was quite upset about the fact that one of our officers was in this fray. You know, Joe Wilson's a public figure. My view of Joe Wilson is that he's fair game. He's a public figure. He's spoken out publicly. I never believed Valerie should have been involved in this in any way, shape, or form, and I never believed that an intelligence officer, a sitting intelligence officer, certainly should be involved in any way. So motives, what happened, you know, all you do is read and speculate. All I can say is that we didn't think it was appropriate. You know, people said, well, she sent Joe Wilson. She didn't send him. She may have made a suggestion, but other people just made that decision. And so my view is, if people have heartburn over Joe, that's fine, but she should never have been involved in any way.
My guest is George Tenet, the former director of Central Intelligence. His new memoir is called At the Center of the Storm. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is George Tenet, the former director of Central Intelligence, and as I'm sure you know by now, he's written a memoir called At the Center of the Storm. You write, time and time again during the months leading up to the invasion and for months thereafter, the representatives of the vice president and Pentagon officials would introduce ideas that were thinly veiled efforts to put Ahmet Chalabi in charge of post-invasion Iraq. My CIA colleagues were aghast. Why?
Well, I guess we understood and believed that no exile, nobody who's been living outside Iraq for so long, nobody who's experienced the pain and suffering of Saddam Hussein is going to really be very credible on the ground. Now, it's not a secret that we, CIA had issues with Chalabi going back many, many years, but at the bottom line and at root, we were greatly skeptical that somebody, an exile or an exile group imposed from the outside would ever have much legitimacy in post-war Iraq. Iraqis had an election. He got no parliamentary seats in that election. I think our view is ultimately validated. And I've now read people who say, well, if only we had, people say, well, if only we had handed this over to Iraqis a lot sooner. Well, the people who make those criticisms believe in their heart of hearts, if only we had handed this over to Ahmed Shalabi, this would have all gone away. Well, we never saw him as an answer.
While you were the director of Central Intelligence, Donald Rumsfeld created the Office of Special Plans to supply the administration with intelligence. This was headed by Douglas Feith, who was the Undersecretary of Defense from July of 01 to August of 05. You say that Douglas Feith mischaracterized intelligence. You describe this as Feith-based intelligence. First of all, what did it say to you that Donald Rumsfeld started his own intelligence unit?
Well, look, my view of all this, of course, is policymakers have a right to push us, prod us, ask us questions. Listen, intelligence is a contact sport on a daily basis. You have a right to do that. My concern about this particular effort and this particular effort was particularly focused on, at least the one issue I was aware of, focused on Iraq and al-Qaeda. You've got to be careful when policymakers come to conclusions about intelligence that the intelligence community and the director of Central Intelligence doesn't share, then you have an obligation to say, I have my own views. These are not the views of the director of Central Intelligence and his analysts. And I believe on this one paper that was written and ultimately shared with the Congress, I believe the paper did mischaracterize our sources. The paper was ultimately withdrawn. We had not cleared on the paper, but the point here is, you know, this was such a heated issue. Iraq and al-Qaeda was such a heated issue that policymakers, in this case, Mr. Feith went off and did his own bit of work. Well, I can't say that that's good government. I can't say that it's a reflection of the way our system is supposed to work. And we should always be questioned on how we've come to our conclusions. You just can't come to your own conclusions if you don't make it clear that they're not ours.
Reading between the lines, would it be fair to say that what you're saying is when you didn't deliver the intelligence that Donald Rumsfeld wanted to hear, he would get it from his own Office of Special Plans?
Well, actually, you know, you have to be careful here. You know, actually, the secretary was a tough taskmaster. I never had a problem with the secretary. The secretary always listened to what I had to say. I think you've got to be careful here about extending this and, you know, branding people and saying things that may or may not be true. Let's just focus on, I don't know what his interaction was with Mr. Feith. I don't know how much Don believed this or didn't believe this or asked him to do it. That's not really the point. I can't speak to that side of the record. I can only speak to you about what I saw, what we thought about it, how we encountered it, how we dealt with it.
How often did information coming out of the Office of Special Plans contradict information that you had gotten from the CIA?
I don't know the answer to that question. People have asked me, well, didn't you see all this running around you? I said, well, you know, actually, I didn't. I had a full-time job. I walked in and saw the President of the United States every day. I told him what the American intelligence community believed. You know, beyond this one case of Iraq and al-Qaeda, if there were other things running around, I never saw them. People say, well, Mr. Tenet, how is that possible? Well, I can only tell you what I experienced. I can only tell you what I saw. I can only tell you, you know, I didn't pay a lot of attention to what was running around me. And this is the one issue that caused me concern because I became aware of it a bit later. But the point of the matter is I can't tell you more because I don't know more.
So what you're saying is that there was one paper that you were aware of that made a specious connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq.
Yeah. And maybe there was more, and maybe there was more debate about this, and maybe there were other issues. I can only tell you that's the one that I ultimately engaged on and joined on.
So how did you kill that paper?
Well, I don't think it was – I think it fell of its own weight ultimately. I believe the paper was sent to Capitol Hill. I believe the paper was ultimately withdrawn. I mean, much has been made of that paper through a recent Department of Defense Inspector General report. I can't take you farther than that, but I don't think the paper lasted very long once it came into public focus.
Once the Office of Special Plans was created, Did you feel like the CIA was included as much? I mean, did that when the Defense
Look,
Department
Terry,
had its own office? Yeah, go ahead.
Look, Terry, I had thousands of people working for me. Al Qaeda was a full-time job. Afghanistan came along. Iraq came along. We had people on the ground. We're writing a president's daily brief every day. We've got liaison relationships around the world. I had plenty to do. So people always want to put you in the moment. You know, I had enough to do and worry about in terms of my own responsibilities. I didn't think very much about these issues at the time. People have asked me contemporaneously, well, what did you think? Well, you know what? Not part of my day, not part of how I thought about my life. I had plenty to do. I believe that I was responsible providing intelligence to this administration. I did it faithfully. And the rest, God only knows.
George Tenet was the director of Central Intelligence from 1997 to 2004. His new memoir is called At the Center of the Storm. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former CIA Director George Tenet on what he describes as son of Iran-Contra. And John Ridley talks about writing The American Way, a comic book about U.S. government propaganda involving superheroes, communist villains, and marketing experts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with George Tenet. He was the director of Central Intelligence from 1997 to 2004. His new memoir, At the Center of the Storm, addresses, among other things, the controversies surrounding his leadership and the CIA's intelligence in the lead-up to September 11th and the invasion of Iraq. Let's talk about Iran a moment. You write that part of the Bush administration was focused on Iraq, but some members of the Bush administration were really focused on Iran. And you write particularly of one incident involving Michael Ledeen, who was actually a character in the Iran-Contra scandal. He introduced Manashir Ghorbanifar, an Iranian arms dealer, to Oliver North. And you describe Ghorbanifar as a con man and a fabricator.
Right. And the history of that is that, of course, Ghorbanifar was put on a, we call in the business, a burn notice. The irony is as I describe in this book, sometime
which
in January.
Which means that you didn't think he was credible.
Yeah, no one from the Central Intelligence Agency will ever meet with this guy.
Okay.
Not credible. So, okay. The story starts in January of 2002 when a senior representative of Italian intelligence came to see us and said, you know, essentially what we knew about U.S. government officials exploring contacts with Iranians. And we all looked at each other and didn't know what he was talking about. Later on, the U.S. ambassador to Italy told our senior officer there that about this meeting that had occurred. Well, in any event, when Secretary Powell and I heard about the fact that U.S. representatives were meeting with Ghorbanifar, we both hit the roof. When we understood that potentially people were talking to these guys about exchanging money in returns for regime change, we said, whoa, we will never meet with this guy. We will never have anything to do with him. Knock it off. And essentially, we succeeded in putting a stop to it. So it was one of those instances where this one came out of left field. But it's very difficult for us to understand. I know Secretary Powell and I felt, we were furious. Don't these people understand the past? Don't they understand what this history is with this particular individual? And that in any event, these are things that should have been deliberated by principals and policy should have been made around, and it was not, and we stopped it.
Now, you write about this meeting that Michael Ledeen had with Manashir Ghorbanifar. What we were hearing sounded like an off-the-books covert action program trying to destabilize the Iranian government. Without the appropriate presidential authorities and without congressional notification, such a program might well be illegal. This started to give the appearance of being son of Iran-Contra. Do you think that members of the Bush administration condoned or participated in this back channel to accomplish covertly what they couldn't do overtly? Is that what you were saying?
Well, I don't know who approved it. All I know is we put a stop to it because we couldn't allow this to occur. I never understood with any precision where it came from in all of its tentacles. All I can tell you is the Secretary of State and I, when we were apprised of it, put a stop to it. So as near as I can tell, we put a stop to it.
Do you think that if we attacked Iran, what do you think the outcome would be if we did attack Iran?
Well, Terry, my thoughts on that are as follows. One, we've got a very difficult situation on our hands in Iraq. Two, many of the instruments of our national power are very, very tired. We've got divisions of the army that have been in Afghanistan and Iraq and back to Iraq. And so people need to show some care about this. The other thing is you need to remember that, just look at the demographics of Iran for a minute, 63% of the Iranian population was born after 1979. They don't share the Ayatollah's view of Iran. And I think when you're talking about a country of 70 million people, the last thing you want to do is drive those people, you know, toward a leadership that I don't believe they have a lot of faith in. Now, you've obviously, I don't know the specifics of where we are on the nuclear issue today, and it's obviously a source of great concern to all of us. I would keep this firmly in the diplomatic track. You obviously never take military options off the table. I understand that, but I would keep this with the international community. I would pressure and sanction the Iranians. I would make them I would talk to the Iranians. I would let them understand no good is going to come of this. This is an economy that's in shambles. These are people who are dissatisfied with their government. I would be very, very careful about talking about the use of force, even though they need to understand it may be on the table on this nuclear question. But I would be very careful. I mean, you know, you can't – everything is about timing, context, and where you are. You can't be at war with Sunni and Shia Islam simultaneously. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
A lot of people have been responding to your book and what you say about the intelligence that you provided the Bush administration, how the Bush administration used it. Michael Scheuer, who was the founding head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, wrote a Washington Post op-ed on Sunday that I'm sure you've read. And he says, at day's end, Tenet's exercise in finger-pointing is designed to disguise the central tragic fact of his book. Tenet, in effect, is saying that he knew all too well why the U.S. should not invade Iraq, and that he told his political masters, and that he was ignored. But above all, he's saying that he lacked the moral courage to resign and speak out publicly to try to stop our country from striding into what he knew would be an abyss. What's your reaction to that?
Well, everybody has the right to an opinion. America's a great country. I react quite negatively to what he has to say. He implies that I understood that all the horrors that would unfold. I didn't. He implies that we sat back and told policymakers what they wanted to hear. We didn't. He implies that we didn't speak truth to power when we got on the ground and saw things unfold that the intelligence was very, very clear about. So, the issue for me, Terry, is that I was the director of Central Intelligence. I'm agnostic on policy issues. I'm not a hero. It's not my job to make policy. I didn't go in and say to the president, don't do this. But at the same time, we were faithful to what we saw. We were faithful to what we wrote. We told the truth as we saw it. As to this matter of resignation, I had a job to do. I had thousands of people I was leading. I had lots of things going on. I did the job to the best of my ability and as honorably as I could. And I find it interesting that people would impugn your honor when they aren't walking in your shoes every day and don't understand all the pressures that you're under.
But it does sound from your book like you felt you were watching the Bush administration lead the country to war because of ideological beliefs as opposed to because of hard intelligence that the CIA was supplying.
Well, remember, Terry, we believe the intelligence was hard. What I'm saying to people is, and I want to be clear about this, I understand the intelligence was wrong. People will say, well, the intelligence was wrong as a function. You're just deflecting responsibility. No, I'm saying that countries go to war for more than just intelligence. They go to war because policymakers believe it's the right thing to do, and they have a whole bunch of things in their kit bag that justify the view that it is. How it all got calibrated, but I believe there were more reasons. And intelligence in their mind may have been important. All I'm saying is there was more to it than that. We have to take our fair share of responsibility. We are responsible for what we wrote. And I'm the first one that's going to stand up and say, this is how we thought about it. This is what we did. Trying to think through lessons that were learned, how we think about this in the future. I'm not trying to stick fingers in people's eyes. I'm not trying to reach, grand conclusions other than to say when I thought about it, here's how I thought about it. Other people will differ. All I can tell you is as I lived through it, as I lived through the torrent of what I was doing every day, as I lived through the pressures of terrorism and having people on the ground in Iraq and providing the best intelligence possible, I'm not going to tell you I had instantaneous special wisdom on all these things. I'm trying to give you a sense of what I saw when I reflected on it. And, there's balance in the book. We did good things. We did bad things. There were things that were done on the terrorism front that I think were spectacularly successful. There were things that happened in Iraq, particularly in the post-war implementation, that I think, don't look very good and weren't very good. And I'm trying to provide as much balance as I can.
George Tenet was the director of Central Intelligence from 1997 to 2004. His new memoir is called At the Center of the Storm. Coming up, a comic book about American propaganda. This is Fresh Air. The American Way is a comic book series about an unusual form of American propaganda. It's set in 1961 during the Cold War, when American superheroes vanquish communist villains in an ongoing series of spectacular battles. But the heroes and villains are creations of the government, the American government, for reasons we'll explain in a minute. Now the series is collected in the form of a graphic novel. The American Way was written by my guest John Ridley. He also wrote the screenplays for the films Undercover Brother and Three Kings. He's an NPR commentator and is working with Spike Lee on a new movie. John Ridley, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe the superheroes in The American Way.
Coming into the comic book, the graphic novel, the superheroes are meant to be icons of America and also shorthand for heroes that may be more familiar to some readers. So you have your Superman archetype, your Wonder Woman, your Captain Marvel. But in The American Way, these characters are meant to represent aspects of America. So they have names like Old Glory and Amber Waves, Muscle Shoals, Ole Miss, the Mighty Delta, Southern Cross. And my favorite name for any of these characters is the East Coast Intellectual.
Describe the East Coast Intellectual physically.
The East Coast Intellectual is basically he's the smartest man in America. He's incredibly intelligent, but represents East Coast sort of professorial intelligentsia.
Now, these superheroes are all part of a group called the Civil Defense Corps, which is what?
The Civil Defense Corps is ostensibly much like the Justice League or the Avengers. It's this group of heroes who come together to save the day from either alien invasions on some occasions or to fight these personifications of evil in America or around the world at that era. It's enemies that are very specific to a time and place and represent real evils that are out there. What we find out in the story is that the Civil Defense Corps, even though most of these heroes have real superpowers, it's sort of a sham. They put on these fights as shows, like wrestling, not in an Orwellian fraud, but to really give hope to America that our society is not going to end tomorrow in atomic ash, that we are not going to fall prey to communism. It's the idea that it's a grand lie to make Americans feel good and to feel safe. And the question becomes in this story, is any lie a good lie? And can you perpetuate these lies over time? What happens when reality overtakes the fraud?
How did you come up with this idea of superheroes who were created by the government to vanquish phony villains just to make Americans feel good and feel secure?
Well, part of the idea, and a lot of the story, for me when I write, I sit around and I think all the time, and I get an idea over here that kind of works, an idea over here that would be interesting, and then I wait for that thing that helps it all coalesce. And for me, the thing that really helped bring this story together was the Jessica Lynch story at the beginning of the second Gulf War, the Iraq War. Here was this young girl. She was out on patrol. Her patrol was ambushed. You know, as the story went, most of her comrades were captured or killed. She fought to the last bullet. She was taken to a secret location, but American commandos found her and an amazing rescue saved her, brought her home. And it's a great story. And it's the story that the Pentagon and the government put out. It's the story that most of the media ran with. And little by little, we found out that that was not actually the story. The idea wasn't that this story was not put out there because the government was evil. It was not entirely made up, but we wanted to believe. At the beginning of the war, who doesn't want to believe a wonderful story about a young girl, an American hero, who is rescued and saved in a spectacular operation? There was nothing wrong, essentially, with that story, except that it wasn't the truth. But we ran with it, and we believed it, and we liked what we were hearing.
One of the superheroes dies because of a heart attack brought on by his smoking addiction. And then he has to be replaced. So the marketing guy comes up with this idea, like, let's find a black man to be the first black superhero. Why does he want to do that? Why does he want to recruit a black man?
Well, the character who is the entree into the story is a guy named Wes. And Wes is a marketing executive and ends up losing his job. And one of his friends from college is Bobby Kennedy. And the Kennedys have just been elected and just been put into office. And Wes gets a call from Bobby Kennedy, and he says to him, look, I've got a job in government that I really want you to help me with. And Wes, being unemployed and his wife is pregnant, says, you know, look, I'll think about it. Comes down to Washington, and Bobby lays all this on him, that these guys being the Civil Defense Corps, are kind of fake. But it's the most important job that we have right now is to make Americans feel safe and strong and secure. and we want you to spearhead this for us and our new administration. Wes being a good liberal guy and also being a guy who wants to feel good when he looks in the mirror and looks at his wife, thinks that the Civil Defense Corps can do more than just representing where America is. They can represent where America should go. And he has this idea, which is we need to integrate this formerly all-white supergroup. We need to bring, in the parlance of the times, a Negro hero to the fore. And they realize that they can't just give a black man superpowers and put him in this group. The idea is that they will hide this guy behind a mask, call him the new American, and after he's a hero for 2 or 3 years, after America completely loves him, they reveal the fact that he's a black man. By the way, this is part of this story is actually based on reality. Lyndon Johnson, when he was vice president after Kennedy had just been elected and initiates the space program, he thought that one of the original Mercury astronauts should be black. And he thought that that would go a long way to quelling race relations in America. And when I heard that, that's another aspect that really helped bring this entire story together.
My guest is John Ridley. He wrote the graphic novel The American Way. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Ridley. We're talking about his comic book series, The American Way, which is now collected in a new graphic novel of the same name. It's set in 1961, during the Cold War, when American superheroes vanquish communist supervillains in an ongoing series of spectacular battles. But the heroes and villains are creations of the American government in a campaign run by marketing experts to make Americans feel good about the government's ability to protect them. After the campaign gets off the ground, the marketing experts decide to create a black superhero. I want you to read the section from The American Way in which the marketing guy from this superhero civil defense corps tries to convince the young African-American man to become a member of the civil defense corps, to become one of these superheroes. And just like set it up in any way that you need to get us on the page.
Well, as you mentioned, you have the marketing guy, Wes, who's been charged with finding, much as with the Mercury astronauts, the guy who's got the right stuff, a black man, or again, as a Negro, as they would say at the time, who's got the right personality, who's got the right aptitude, and who can handle having his body transformed into basically a superhuman. They find this individual, a guy named Jason Fisher, who at the time is like a lot of young black people. He's very much a hothead. He's very much got a lot of opinions, but up to this point hasn't really engaged himself in the civil rights process. So as we come into this scene, Jason has been sat down in a room in the government, and like a lot of black people are probably sat down in a room by the government or government officials, doesn't like what's going on, and Wes has to convince him that he's actually there for a higher purpose. So we come in, this first line is from an angry Jason. "Hey, I know my rights. You better let me see a lawyer, you lousy." This is Wes. "Right, yeah, I'm the blue-eyed devil, and you're the oppressed minority, always getting shafted by the man. We did that dialogue already. You care to move on?" "So you're Jason Fisher, you're a Howard grad paratrooper with the U.S. Army. 3 years ago, you were discharged for striking another soldier." "Jason, he made the mistake of calling me a nigger to my face, and I didn't strike him, I ripped his ear off." "Wes, he was junior grade, you could have had him court-martialed." "Jason, I don't know what military you were in. I was in the one that cares more about race than rank. The brass wouldn't have done..." "Wes, in the years since, you haven't held a job to speak of, despite having a master's degree. Jason, nothing America fears more than an educated black man. Wes, maybe America's not the problem. Maybe you are. Jason, do you even own a television? You see how they treat us, overcrowd us in the ghetto, lynch us down south? Wes, and what have you ever done about it except talk loud and act angry? What have you ever done for your people? Jason, what are you offering? Wes, just the chance to heal the country, be an icon to America, white and colored alike, but that's about it. Jason, the word is Negro, and that sounds like some blue-eyed crap to me. Wes, then accept my offer. Prove me a liar. Otherwise, you're just another Negro who wants to change things but won't do anything to get there. Do you have what it takes to be a hero?
What's going on in that scene? And who's playing who?
In terms of who's trying to get one over on the other individual?
Mm-hmm.
I think that both individuals honestly are coming into this trying to believe that they're doing what's right. I think for me, relating this to 2007, there are a lot of black people out there who are angry, and in some cases very rightfully so, but we have to ask ourselves, particularly with what's going on in America, where are we focusing our anger? Are we focusing at the system, or are we looking at ourselves as saying, look, we are part of the system, particularly now in writing this? I do want to speak to a modern audience, not necessarily write a love letter to 1961. Look, we're at a place where potentially a black man in the near future could be president of the United States of America. If that happens, there are a lot of black people in America who are going to have to give up the line that says America is racist. Now, it's not to say that there aren't now and there won't always be racists in America. But if a black man is elected president, we can't say that America is racist. So we have to sort of change our dialogue in terms of how we address other people in this country and also how we look at where we as black people are moving in this country. Also with Wes, I think there's a level of an individual, and particularly talking about people who are, or white people who are very much in the liberal camp, who think that they can talk through issues and intellectualize issues, and in so make those issues either go away or be able to address them or make them better. I don't think that's necessarily true. And I think that for black America, we understand the ills and the evils of the extreme far reactionary right. I mean, that's what we've been up against since we got dropped off on a boat and got our teeth checked and were sold into slavery. On the other end, I think that there is extreme liberalism, and I think that there is danger in extreme liberalism. And I think that that's what we have to look at in terms of where we are now and where we are on a liberal plantation. And I do believe that there's a soft bigotry out there. And I do believe for us as black Americans, having succeeded when we faced all the dire consequences that were put against us, slavery and the failed Reconstruction and Jim Crow and the Civil Rights era, and we've succeeded against all those things. Why is it in some areas of black America we are still failing? I think we can't look towards the extreme right in those circumstances. I think sometimes we have to look towards the extreme left and how it treats us and what we need to do to move to the next level.
When you said that there are dangers of extreme liberalism, what were you referring to?
I think that there is an idea in some areas of the black community of eternal victimization, that it's always the white guy who's causing problems, that it's if it's the government that's against us, it's racism that's against us, that we need affirmative action in all instances, that we need handouts, we need the largesse of white people to get ahead. I think that those ideas of black people, blacks who preach to black people that we are always victims, just reinforces in our head that we are victims. But you look at black America and you look at the successes, I don't think those two concepts, they actually equate with one another. How can we always be victims and yet succeed both in personal life, in public life, and in social life? Actually, both. Those are three things. I don't think that the idea that we are victims, yet we can succeed, they don't really jive with one another.
You work in movies, television, books, comic books. Are you satisfied with the diversity of ways in which African Americans are depicted in American entertainment now?
No. absolutely not. I think it's getting better, but you look at the success of The Cosby Show in the 80s, and you wonder why there aren't more images of middle-class blacks in television and movies and things like that. You certainly see more black people that are out there. I mean, you've got, you know, Forrest Whitaker, you know, winning an Oscar, and Jennifer Hudson winning an Oscar. It's taken for granted that there will be strong performances and good roles for people of color that are out there. And that's absolutely terrific. But in your day-to-day broadcasting, you just don't see a lot of positive images. And there's nothing wrong inherently with the hip hop image. There's nothing wrong inherently with the images that are perpetuated in, say, like the NBA of black males. But, you know, with women in these hip hop videos, I mean, they're always video hoes, almost always. I don't think that's particularly positive. The idea of black people being just about entertaining in sports and putting the ball in the hoop or running the ball down the field. Some of these individuals are wonderful individuals. They're involved in their communities. They're good people. I don't want to say that if you're involved in the NBA or you're an athlete, there's something inherently wrong with that. But is that the predominant image that we want to see out there as black Americans? And also in terms of real media, you can go through watching the news, you know, from morning to night and see so few black people delivering the news, adding commentary, putting voice out there. And generally when they are out there, they tend to be your Al Sharpton types who express a single point of view, and that then is considered to be the majority black point of view. And the reality is that Al Sharpton is in by no means does he express the majority view of black people.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. I truly appreciate it.
John Ridley wrote the graphic novel The American Way. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Growing Girls, The Mother of All Adventures, a collection of essays on motherhood by columnist Jean Marie Laskus. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards. On the web at creditcards.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon talks about his detective novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. The novel reimagines history based on this premise. What if the State of Israel collapsed in 1948 and displaced Jews were given a temporary homeland in Alaska? Join us for the next Fresh Air.